This is Audible.
Listening Library presents The Boy Who Dared by Susan Campbell Bartoletti. Read for you by David Aykroyd. Death Row, Plautzensee Prison, Berlin, Germany. October 27th, 1942. Day 264. It's morning. Soft gray light slips over the tall red brick wall. It stretches across the exercise yard and reaches through the high, barred windows. In a cell on the ground floor, the light shifts dark shapes into a small stool, a scrawny table, and a bed made of wooden boards with no mattress or blanket. On that bed, a thin, huddled figure, Helmut, a boy of 17, lies awake, shivering, trembling. It's a Tuesday. The executioner works on Tuesdays. Memories drift through Helmut's mind like clouds, clouds that obscure his intense fear of what is to come. Slowly they shift into shapes. Helmut, holding Mutti's hand. It's 1928, and Helmut and his mother stroll up Luisensweg, the Hammerbrook Street in Hamburg, where they live in a small flat next door to Helmut's grandparents. Helmut is 3. He is wearing short black pants and brown ankle boots that lace up. His older half-brother, Hans, is 8. Hans is wearing short pants and ankle boots, too. So is Gerhard, who is 7. They are walking ahead of Mutti. Helmut worries that his brothers will get lost, or worse, that they will have fun without him. Helmut tugs on Mutti's hand. He wants to escape, wants to catch up with his brothers, but Mutti tugs back. "No," she says, "stay close, hold my hand. I don't want to lose you." That makes Helmut feel dark inside. It isn't fair that he has to hold Mutti's hand, and his brothers do not. A street. Helmut sees this, too. A noisy, crowded street. It's a parade. Brown-shirted men wearing red and black armbands and tall, black, shiny boots are marching. One swaggering brown shirt bends over Helmut. "What a big boy you are," he says. "Do you want to be a soldier for the fatherland?" Helmut likes to play with toy soldiers. He forgets he is angry at Mutti. He nods and tells the brown shirt, "Yes!" The brown shirt laughs a big, booming laugh. He pats Helmut's head. "A smart boy," he says to Mutti. "And brave. Already he wants to fight for the fatherland. And his eyes. So alert. Look how they take in everything." "Yes," says Mutti in a proud voice. "He's very smart. And very brave, too." A loud bell clangs. Bright prison lights snap on. Helmut sits, stretches. It's cold. He rubs his arms beneath his drab, gray prison smock. He steps across the bare floor to the corner, raises his smock, urinates into the slop bucket. For a moment, the cell grows thick with the stink from the bucket, and then thins, becomes ordinary again. He lifts his bed against the wall, hooks it into place, sits on the stool, waits. Another memory, 1932. It's nighttime. Helmut is 7. He lies on his back, tucked into bed between Hans and Gerhard. Helmut hears Mutti dressing for work, the smooth wooden glide of bureau drawers, open, shut, open, shut. His grandparents live in the flat next door. Through the wall, Helmut hears a sonata from Opa's gramophone, a somber cello warm and penetrating. Brahms. It is a comfort to have Opa and Oma so close. That's what Mutti says, though sometimes she presses her lips together as she says it. And a help, too, since Mutti works nights at the nursing home and needs someone to check on her boys. Moonlight floods the bedroom, shimmers the walls, opalescent. It makes Helmut think about God and heaven. heaven goes on forever, doesn't it? He whispers to his brothers. It's always Gerhardt who answers these questions, never Hans. For infinity, says Gerhardt, who is nearly 4 years older than Helmut, and knows about heavenly things like planets and stars and suns and moons. Gerhardt likes precise words and numbers. Hans, 5 years older and with little patience for deep discussions, is already asleep, or pretending to be. How can something never end? Says Helmut. How does it go on and on for infinity? It just does, says Gerhardt. That's the way God made the universe, without beginning or end, in all directions. In all directions, repeats Helmut, awestruck. It makes me dizzy just thinking about it. He stops, thinks about the feeling. It isn't dizzy, not exactly. I'm floating, he says. Then stop, says Gerhardt. I can't stop. I'm going to float away. Right this minute. Hold on to me, Gerhardt. Don't be ridiculous. You're not going to float away. Ridiculous is one of Gerhardt's favorite words. I will, too. No, you won't. There's such a thing as gravity. God made that, too, you know. But I am floating, says Helmut. He rolls toward Gerhardt, clutches his arm. Gerhardt pulls away. You're ridiculous. He gives Helmut a heave, shoves him toward the center of the bed, says in a practical voice, When you are old enough to think about infinity, it won't make you float. Now, go to sleep. But I like floating, whispers Helmut into the shimmering darkness. And he does. It makes him feel drawn to God, as if God is drawing him toward heaven. He doesn't say this to Gerhardt because he doesn't want the feeling to disappear. Besides, he knows that Gerhardt has stopped listening. That's the way Gerhardt is, so able to remain anchored in the world. And so Helmut keeps floating toward heaven until he falls fast asleep. Another memory. School is out, and Helmut is sitting on the floor playing with lead soldiers. He is next door at his grandparents' flat, because Muti is still asleep, tired from her night shift. He forms two lines with blue-clad French soldiers dug in on one side and gray-clad Germans attacking mercilessly on the other, just as they had fought on the Western Front during the Great War. Gerhardt comes in and squats next to Helmut. Your right flank is in trouble, he says, pointing. You can't keep your soldiers in a straight line. You must circle the enemy. Helmut tenses his jaw. He wants to argue with Gerhardt, such a know-it-all he is. But he also sees his brother is right. Gerhardt is always right. And so Helmut moves a handful of Germans to protect the right flank. Gerhardt nods in approval. That's better. You can't think in straight lines, not if you want to win. Gerhardt plops down on the stiff, flat sofa and cracks open his Karl May adventure novel. Helmut crouches over the battlefield. He signals a charge to encircle the French. He imitates the sound of artillery, exploding grenades, storms of shrapnel. He imagines billows of smoke as the brave German infantry attack with all their might. Their faces are dust-covered, their uniforms tattered. Opa returns from his midday walk with a newspaper he has bought from a stall in the market square. He stands over Helmut. Who's winning? The Germans, says Helmut. Are the grenade launchers on their way? Helmut nods vigorously. Your strategy is working. The French are trapped, says Opa. As it should have been, my boy. We should never have lost that war. Oma bustles from the kitchen, carrying a teapot. The sharp scent of peppermint hovers in the air. Opa sits, flaps open the newspaper, mutters about the headlines. More head-cracking, he says. More fighting between communists and the social democrats and the Nazis. Each party promises jobs and a stronger economy. Can it get any worse? Asks Oma. Only if that lunatic Hitler comes to power, says Opa. That will mean only one thing. War. That warmonger wants to make his mark on history. Oma sits next to Opa and says, Hitler frightens me. Those crazy eyes of his. And the way he knows exactly how to bring a crowd to hysteria. For a long while, Opa and Oma sit in silence, his hand cupped over hers. Helmut knows they are afraid of Adolf Hitler, the leader of the Nazi Party. But he doesn't understand why they fear a man who wants to fight for Germany and make it better. Helmut rocks back on his heels, looks at his toy soldiers. If he were a soldier, he would fight bravely for Germany, just as Hitler fought in the Great War. He knows he would. He wouldn't be afraid. Footsteps. A rustling sound at the heavy blue door. Helmut takes a great gulp of air. His heart pounds in his ears. The small, latched window slides open. Please, God, no. Not the executioner. He sees an eye, a nose, half a mouth, half a face. The morning guard. Helmut breathes again. Part of a prisoner's punishment is not knowing his execution date. For a second, their eyes meet. The guard pushes a cup of lukewarm malt coffee and a hunk of dry bread through the window. The window snaps shut. Helmut rejoices with relief, gives thanks for the meager breakfast, for living to eat another morning meal. He knows letters have been written on his behalf asking for clemency. Perhaps today will bring good news. He gnaws on the hard, stale bread. Thinks about the breakfasts Mutti made. Rye toast slicked with red currant jam made with berries that Helmut picked himself. For supper they ate whatever Mutti could afford to cook that day. Usually turnips and potatoes and cabbage. Helmut and his brothers never went to bed hungry, Mutti made sure of that. But there were plenty of nights he wished for something more to eat. He remembers how all of Germany was very poor, and how Adolf Hitler promised to make everything better. Work and bread, that's what Hitler promised. Helmut remembers the day Hitler was appointed chancellor. How the flat smelled of fresh rye bread and sausage and fried onions. Mutti celebrated. Everyone did. It is January 30th, 1933, and nearly noon. It's almost dismissal time, and Helmut is sitting on a hard wooden chair in the school auditorium. He is waiting for a special radio broadcast, a broadcast so important that the whole school has been gathered to listen. At first, his classmates sit quietly. As the minutes tick toward dismissal, the boys fidget, swinging their legs, tapping the floor with their heavy brown shoes, whispering and snickering when their teachers aren't looking. Helmut is filled with a sense of anticipation. Something big is about to happen. He can feel it, has felt it for days. It has something to do with Adolf Hitler, he is sure. At the front of the auditorium, a fifth-grade teacher turns on the large radio. It crackles, and a stormy arpeggio from the final movement of Beethoven's Moonlight Sonata bursts forth. Its ferocity underscores the day's unquiet. The teacher twists the knob, tunes in the German Reichsstation, the RRG. The radio squawks, and then a newscaster speaks in a whisper. Guten Tag. Good day, he says, as if he doesn't want to disturb anyone, as if he is about to apologize for interrupting the school day. But he doesn't apologize. Instead, his booming voice fills the auditorium. Reich President Paul von Hindenburg has just formed a new government. Adolf Hitler, leader of the National Socialist Party, has been sworn into office as the new Chancellor of the Reich. Martial music swells from the speakers. Something inside Helmut swells, too. It has happened. Hitler is chancellor. This is big news. The room buzzes. Several older boys, sixth graders, leap to their feet. They clap one another on the back, thrust out their right arms in the Nazi salute, and bark, Heil Hitler! Helmut is amazed at their boldness. Even more amazed that not one teacher grabs them by the collar and shakes them, tells them to sit, to mind their manners. Those swaggering boys belong to the Jungvolk, the Hitler Youth Group for boys 10 to 14. They sport brown shirts and swastika armbands, shiny belts and buckles, and best of all, daggers inscribed with the words "Blood and Honor" that glint from leather sheaths. The boy's eyes glitter. "Did you hear that, Seligman?" says one boy, leering. There aren't many Jews in the school, but the Hitler Youth want the schoolyard Judenfrei, Jew-free. Benno Seligman ignores their taunts. He gazes stonily ahead, but two angry red splotches glow on his cheeks. The teachers ignore the Hitler Youth. They are too busy whispering sharply with the other teachers, fighting over the reasons why Germany is so desperate for Adolf Hitler. It's the same grown-up argument Helmut has heard everywhere, between his mother and his grandparents, among his neighbors in the tenement, floating out of the teacher's room at school, and even among the older boys in the schoolyard. "At last, wait and see," says one teacher. "Hitler will get Germany out of this mess. No more unemployment, no more inflation. He will bring jobs, food for our tables." Another teacher shakes his head. "Bah! Hitler is a lunatic. He will bring war." And so the argument goes back and forth among the teachers. "Nonsense! Hitler wants peace, a strong Germany. Wait and see. He will restore our greatness." "The problem is that treaty. It's a sacrilege." Helmut knows about the Treaty of Versailles, the peace agreement that ended the Great War in 1918. The treaty forced Germany to take all the blame for starting the war and to pay high reparations that made Germany poor. The treaty caused unemployment, poverty, inflation, and mostly it brought shame and humiliation to Germany. A few teachers seem unconcerned by these arguments. They shrug their shoulders and stand idly with their hands in their pockets. "What do I care? Hitler? What does it matter? All their promises sound the same. Nothing but lies. Mark my words. Hitler won't last long. The German people won't be ruled by an idiot. Hitler will be hard on the Jews. I would not want to be a Jew in Germany. Hitler's just huffing and puffing about the Jews. He knows how to play up patriotism by giving people a common enemy. He makes people afraid, that's what he does. It's bad, the things that can happen when people become afraid." Helmut glances back at Benno Seligman. Helmut doesn't know many Jews besides Benno and Benno's father, who owns a butcher shop. And there's Herr Kaltenbach, the baker, who gives Helmut extra apple cake trimmings. Helmut doesn't know why being a Jew is a big deal. Jews are children of Israel, God's first chosen people. That's what the Bible says. And that's what Helmut's church teaches. He's a Mormon and belongs to the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Mormons believe that people have a right to worship how or where or what they want. It's written right in the 13 Articles of Faith, Article 11 to be exact. School is dismissed and Helmut runs outside. He looks for Gerhard and Hans, but he doesn't see them. The wind is biting cold and blowing from the north. It sweeps across the wide Elbe River and across Hamburg's channels and lakes. Helmut pulls his black woolen cap over his ears. The Hammerbrook streets teem with excitement. Stormtroopers wearing swastika armbands and tall, shiny jackboots shout, "Deutsches Volk erwache! Dem Nationalsozialismus gehört die Zukunft! German people awaken! The National Socialists are the future!" On the corner, several stormtroopers, or the SA, as members of Hitler's private army are called, are passing out white leaflets that announce a victory parade through downtown Hamburg that night. "Do you know who Hitler is?" a stormtrooper asks Helmut. "The leader of the National Socialist Party," says Helmut. "And now he's our chancellor." "Smart boy," says the stormtrooper. He hands Helmut a leaflet. "Come to the parade. Watch Germany awaken. Germany needs soldiers like you to fight for the fatherland." "Soldiers like you." The praise squares Helmut's shoulders, and he beams at the stormtrooper. He snatches a leaflet, folds it, and slides it into his pocket. All around it is snowing leaflets. The wind flutters them over the cobblestones like snow. The streets and sidewalks lie littered with white paper. The air is charged with excitement. Helmut feels electric with excitement, too. Someday he will fight for the fatherland. He can feel it, knows in his heart that it's true. The hallway outside his flat smells sweet, like sausage and fried onions. Helmut drops his leather satchel near the door. In the kitchen, Muti stands at the stove and tends a large black skillet. She has dark circles under her eyes from not enough sleep. Muti never sleeps enough. She is always tired. Tired from working nights at the nursing home, tired from the elderly people and their demands, tired from scrubbing the nursing home floors, changing the patients' beds, from raising three boys alone. Boys need a father, that's what Oma says. About that, Muti never argues with her mother. She just says she's doing her best. But Helmut knows Muti is tired of Oma's advice, too. Muti divorced Hans and Gerhard's father long ago, and she never married Helmut's father. She doesn't like talking about that man, not one bit. Helmut clutches the leaflet as he watches Muti brown the sausage and onions. "Have you heard?" he asks. "About Hitler?" Muti smiles and taps the wooden spoon against the frying pan rim, then rests it on the counter. Helmut senses that he is her favorite, though she would never say so. He senses that Gerhard and Hans know it, too. "How can I not hear?" says Muti, with all the shouting and marching. "Who can sleep with all the excitement? We're celebrating, with sausage and onions and sauerkraut. No more soup. Before you know it, we'll eat veal and potato dumplings and plum kuchen every day." Plum cake. It's Helmut's favorite. He takes his mother's good mood as a sign. He shores up his courage and shows her the leaflet. "Bitte, Muti. Please, may I go?" Muti barely glances at the leaflet, doesn't even think it over. "Ach, nein," she says firmly. "You're too young." "What if Hans and Gerhard take me?" His mother hesitates. Helmut uses her hesitation to dig in a toehold. "I'll stay by them. They will watch me. I'll be careful. We will be careful together." Helmut feels her giving in, but Muti shakes her head, her dark brown hair billowing around her pretty face, her pale, tired face, and says, "Nein, it is verboten. I forbid you to go. You're not old enough. If something happened to you, I'd never forgive myself." Helmut crumples the leaflet, shoves it into his pocket. Darkness spreads through him. It isn't fair. "You let Hans and Gerhard go." "Never mind about your brothers. They're older." Helmut scuffs at the floor with the toe of his shoe. His classmates will talk about the parade tomorrow. They will boast how their fathers took them. If only Helmut had a father, things would be different. A father would let him go. A father would take Helmut himself. After supper, Muti hums as she dresses for her job at the nursing home. Helmut turns on Muti's old radio. It's a small luxury to have a radio. Each month, Muti pays a tax to the Reichspost. That makes Oma click her tongue in disapproval. But the radio makes Muti happy. Helmut twists the dial and finds the Reich station, the RRG. He turns up the volume to tune out Muti. Over the radio, the RRG blares reports that the parade to celebrate Hitler's victory is underway. Thousands of flag-waving revelers are lining Germany's streets. Helmut glances at the clock. It's nearly 7. Hans and Gerhard are still not home. Helmut can barely stand it. He feels certain that Muti has allowed them to ride the train into the city center. He's convinced that they are jostling and pushing for a place on the sidewalk outside City Hall. And later, when they return home, they will rub it in that they are old enough to participate in the celebration, and he is not. Muti kisses the top of Helmut's head. "Your brothers will be home soon. Oma will come over to tuck you in," she says as she slips into her old brown woolen coat. It's so worn the edges are frayed, and so huge it swallows her up, so tiny is she. At the door, she trills her fingers goodbye. She feels bad, Helmut can tell. Good. She should feel bad. He doesn't wave back, sits sullenly at the table. He's 8, old enough to put himself to bed. Helmut turns up the volume on the radio, and the sounds of the parade fill the flat. He rests his chin on his hand and closes his eyes. He imagines the sidewalks jammed with revelers sporting swastika armbands and waving red, white, and black flags. He hears the brass bands, too, and the living room gleams bright with the showy flutes and trumpets and trombones. He imagines the streets booming with Nazi stormtroopers, hundreds of them, like distant thunder, marching straight-legged, 12 abreast, singing in echoing voices, "We have broken the bounds of servitude. For us it was a great victory. We shall march on and on, even if all is destroyed. For today Germany shall hear us, and tomorrow the entire world." Beneath the singing, Helmut feels the drums. They stir his blood, call him to duty, make his legs long to leap away from the table, away from the radio, and run down to the inner city to join the marchers. The flat door cracks open. It's Oma, wearing her house coat and slippers, come to shoo Helmut to bed. "Your mother spoils you, letting you stay up this late," Oma says, clucking her disapproval. But she leaves the radio on. Helmut crawls between the bed covers, shivers. It's cold without Gerhard and Hans to warm the bed. He thinks about the stormtrooper earlier that day, how he said Germany needs soldiers, soldiers like him, and he feels a deep love for all things German. Helmut tries to stay awake, but somehow he falls asleep. By morning, the radio is quiet, and there lie Gerhard and Hans, fast asleep, anchored on either side of him. 2 nights later, Helmut lies belly down on the living room floor, listening to Hitler's first speech over the radio. Hitler speaks plainly, in words easy to understand. Helmut likes the sound of Hitler's voice, the way his rasping, barking voice pulses with energy. It charges Helmut up, makes his own heart beat with fear as Hitler warns that communism could destroy the fatherland. "It seeks to poison and disrupt in order to hurl us into an epoch of chaos," shouts Hitler. "Beginning with the family, communists have undermined the very foundations of morality and faith, and scoff at culture and business, nation and fatherland, justice and honor." As their new chancellor, Hitler promises to protect Germany from communists. He also promises to restore greatness to Germany, and he calls upon the German people to join in. "Every class and every individual must help us create the new Reich," Hitler implores. "The national government will preserve and defend those basic principles on which our country has been built. It regards Christianity as the foundation of our national morality and the family as the basis of national life." Nation, Christianity, morality, family. Helmut knows these things are very important. The speech isn't very long, and at its end, Hitler prays, "May God Almighty give our work his blessing, strengthen our purpose, and endow us with wisdom and the trust of our people, for we are fighting not for ourselves, but for Germany." "See," says Mutti to Opa, "Hitler wants what's best for us." Opa disagrees. "He wins the kingdom by flattery, just as the Bible warns us," he says, clicking off the radio. "But like it or not, Hitler's our chancellor now." And so the morning of day number 264 begins like every other morning on death row. Helmut uses the slop bucket again, a handful of cut-up newspaper squares in his hand. He picks out the ones with Hitler's name and uses those to scrape himself. It's the end of February. Helmut stirs awake as Mutti pulls up the bed covers, smooths them, bends over him, and kisses his forehead. "Mutti," he murmurs, "I was dreaming about a sparrow." He doesn't want to open his eyes, doesn't want the dreamy, flying feeling to go away. The bed sinks as Mutti sits beside him. "God watches over sparrows," she says softly. "The sparrow guides the soul to heaven." Her voice cracks a little, the way it does when she's anxious or troubled. "Now go to sleep," she says. Muti stands. She closes the bedroom door behind her, but Helmut is wide awake now. He slips from bed, finds Muti sitting in the dark listening to the radio, her hand over her mouth. The radio dial glows amber. "Muti? What's happened? Is it bad?" She hushes him, pulls him onto her lap. "The Reichstag is on fire," blares the radio newscaster. "Burning out of control." This is shocking news. The Reichstag is the parliament building, the seat of government in Berlin. And now it's on fire. "Adolf Hitler has pronounced the raging fire a communist plot," cries the newscaster. "A plot to take over the German government. Germans must remain on ready alert." Helmut's eyes open wide. "Are we in danger?" "No, not us," says Muti, pulling Helmut close. "We're safe. They've already arrested the culprit." "How do we know it's the right person?" asks Helmut. "They said so on the radio," says Muti. "Hitler will protect us from communists." She grasps his shoulders, steers him toward his bedroom. "Now go to bed." Helmut crawls between Gerhard and Hans, who are both sound asleep. The windows are closed against the cold, but Helmut can hear the steady wail of a police siren. The police must be off to arrest communists, Helmut assures himself. That's good. Jail is a good place for people who want to destroy the government. More swastika flags hatch overnight, and the next day they flutter like bright birds from balconies and windows everywhere. That afternoon, Helmut is eating bread with strawberry jam when Opa's good friend Heinrich Vorps knocks loudly on the door. Brother Vorps is a peculiar old man, full of opinions, and everything he thinks he says in a loud voice. Brother Vorps just can't help himself, that's what Oma says. Helmut likes the old man, shouts and all, everyone does. Brother Vorps waves a newspaper at Opa. The headline blares in thick, bold letters. "Reichstag burns. Communist threat turned back. Hitler declares emergency decree for protection of state and people." "That carpet chewer!" cries Brother Vorps. "This new decree takes away our freedoms. Freedom of speech? Gone. Freedom of the press? Gone. Right to privacy? Gone. The police can search our home, listen to our telephone calls, read our mail. And Hitler calls it protection. Sometimes I think the biggest winner is the biggest liar." Helmut is shocked at Brother Vorps. Brother Vorps is a Mormon, just like Helmut's family. Mormons are taught to respect their country and its leaders, even if one disagrees with them. "But the communists burn our Reichstag," says Helmut. "Hitler wants to protect us." "It's not the communists we must fear," says Brother Vorps. "Now we must fear what we say to our neighbors, what we say in our own homes, what we say over the telephone, what we write." Opa tries to calm down Brother Vorbs. "The decree is just a temporary inconvenience. A few freedoms aren't too much to sacrifice for safety." Helmut is surprised. It's the first time that he has heard his grandfather agree with Hitler. "How can you say that?" says Brother Vorbs. "Decree or no decree, I have always spoken the truth, and I intend to continue to do so." He stands, thrusts his black felt hat onto his head. Oma comes from the kitchen, wipes her hands on her apron. She motions to a chair at the table. "Come, Brother Vorps, sit." But Brother Vorps won't stay, even though Oma asks two times. "I can't sit," he says. "I need to walk to settle my stomach." Opa folds the newspaper and sets it down. He follows Brother Vorps to the door. "The decree won't last forever," says Opa. "Nor will Hitler," says Brother Vorps. "That's what I pray for. I will never vote for a Nazi, no matter what they promise us." Helmut glances at the folded newspaper. He sees a photograph of the arsonist, a squinting, tousle-headed young man. Oma peers over Helmut's shoulder and clicks her tongue. "So young," she says. "I can't help but wonder how Hitler knew so quickly it was a communist plot." Helmut can't stop staring at the culprit's face. What will happen to him? He asks Alma.
The Nazis will find him guilty, no doubt, she says with a sigh. They'll sentence him to death. That's what happens to traitors.
She clicks her tongue again.
So young.
A week later, it's election day, and Opa and Oma dress in their Sunday best. They stroll arm in arm to vote at the town hall. Later, they hear the results. The Nazi Party has gained a slight majority of seats in the Reichstag. Even people who despise Hitler have voted for Nazis, believing that the Nazis are the best protection from communists. Suddenly, brown uniforms sprout up everywhere. Helmut's teacher, Herr Zeiger, wears his SA uniform to school, and his Nazi party badge winks in the light as he struts around the classroom. He holds up the Volkische Beobachter, the Nazi party newspaper, to Helmut's class. The headline shouts in thick letters, Germany, defend yourselves! Don't shop at Jewish stores! Look what the Jews force us to do, says Herr Zeiger. We must boycott the Jews in order to save the fatherland. Benno Seligman's eyes narrow to pinpricks. It's no secret that the Jews hate Hitler and have called for an economic boycott. Jews all over the world have called on fellow Jews to boycott German goods in order to protest Hitler and the Jew-hating Nazi regime. A classmate raises his hand.
My father says the Jews want to cripple the fatherland's economy. Then they will take over.
Exactly, says Herr Zeiger.
We have 6 million unemployed and 3 million more so poor that they can't put food on the table. Haven't we Germans suffered enough already?
Do you want your mothers and fathers to suffer more? The students murmur in agreement. Helmut thinks about Mutti, how hard she works, how tired she is. He doesn't want Mutti to suffer more. But all the things Herr Zeiger says about the Jews feel terribly wrong. Unease crawls over Helmut. Herr Zeiger glares at Benno and lowers his pointer, aiming it like a sword.
You'll see, Klaas, Jews are traitors who want to destroy Germany. And what does the Jew Seligman say to that?
This shocks Helmut. Benno Seligman and his family traitors? How can that be? Benno's father flies the gold and black flag of the Weimar Republic. A portrait of Reich President Hindenburg hangs in his butcher shop. Herr Seligman fought in the Great War, where he was wounded and earned the Iron Cross for his bravery. He wears his lieutenant's uniform on national holidays. Herr Zeiger doesn't wait for Benno to answer. He stalks around the room.
We must defend ourselves against bankruptcy. We must defend ourselves against Jews and their worldwide plot to take over Germany. We must fight back. If Jews want to boycott everything German, then we must boycott everything Jewish.
He stops at Benno's desk and leans into his face. After all, it's an eye for an eye, isn't it? An eye for an eye makes the whole world blind, Herr Zeiger, says Benno. This infuriates Herr Zeiger. His neck stretches into tight cords as he screams,
See how the Jew twists my words? See why Jews can't be trusted?
Herr Zeiger grabs Benno's collar, drags him to a front row seat, shoves him into the chair.
Sit here,
he says, his face purple with rage, so we can keep an eye on you. Benno sits, chin jutted. Doesn't look the least bit sorry. The next day, Herr Seligman and his wife come to school to meet with the head teacher. Benno retrieves his books and never comes to class again. He is transferred to the Jewish school. April in Hamburg is usually cool and damp, but the first day in April, a Saturday, is sunny. Mutti hands Helmut a 5-pfennig coin and tells him to buy a bag of apple cake trimmings from Herr Kaltenbach. Helmut rushes outside and turns east onto Suderstrasse, the street where the Kaltenbach bakery and several other Jewish shops are housed. He stops short at the sight of brown and black uniforms. SS and SA men are everywhere, plastering posters on walls, stretching banners.
Germans, do not buy from Jews. World Jewry is out to destroy us.
There are Hitler Youth, too. Boys Helmut knows, older boys from his school, scrawling the word Jew in thick yellow paint and painting crude yellow outlines of the Star of David on windows, doors, Kaltenbach Bakery, Abraham Tobacco and Cigarette Import, Baumgarten Hats for Women, Cebulski Shoes, Galevsky Women's and Children's Clothing, Seligman's Butcher Shop. Outside Herr Kaltenbach's bakery, a stormtrooper stands. His legs are wide, his arms folded across his chest, his face tightly muscled. On the store window, the words, "Germans, don't buy from Jews," have been painted. Over the front door, a yellow star glares thick with wet paint. Helmut spots Herr Kaltenbach inside, a short, round, kind-looking man with wisps of white hair and a spotless white apron. His wooden cases gleam, their paper-lined trays heaped with pastries and breads and cakes. Herr Kaltenbach paces back and forth, rubbing his hands together. He reaches into his apron pocket, extracts a white handkerchief and mops his glistening forehead. Helmut clutches the coin and starts for the door.
"Judenladen," growls the stormtrooper. "This is a Jewish shop."
Just then, there are shouts. Helmut glances across the street. Benno Seligman's father is standing outside his shop, wearing of all things his lieutenant's uniform from the Great War, medals and all. He has a bucket and is washing the slurs from his window, smearing the yellow paint into huge, wet circles.
"Halt!" barks a stormtrooper.
Herr Seligman turns and says calmly, "My windows are dirty. Surely I have a right to wash my store windows." The street grows quiet. The air ripens, smells rotten. Helmut wants to beg Herr Seligman to stop. But Herr Seligman dunks the scrub cloth into the bucket, wrings it out, and continues wiping the window. Four snarling stormtroopers rush in. They topple Herr Seligman, batter him, pile blows on him, kick him. He curls into a ball, protecting his head and stomach. Helmut cries out at the thuds of fists, the hard grind of boots against bone, the grunts, the groans, and then silence. The Nazis drag their arms across their damp foreheads, looking strangely flushed, exhilarated. They suck on their knuckles and brush the dirt from their uniforms. Herr Seligman's rumpled body lies motionless on the sidewalk. A sick feeling rises in Helmut's stomach. His mouth tastes sour. He glances at the bakery. The window shades are drawn, the store dark. Herr Kaltenbach gone. Helmut heads down the street. He buys the cake trimmings from a German baker who looks most pleased at all his new customers. Helmut hands Mutti the package, and when she peers inside, she notices the trimmings right away. "These are not Herr Kaltenbach's," she says. Helmut swallows hard. He tells Mutti about the stormtroopers, the boycott, the banners, the painted Stars of David, and Herr Seligman. The words feel dirty as a lie in his mouth.
"How dare that brown-shirted pest tell us where to shop," says Oma. "I will shop where I please." "I don't want you to take any chances," says Opa sternly. "Do you hear me? I forbid it. This hatred can't last forever." "And until then?" says Oma.
Opa reaches for a cake trimming, takes a bite.
"These aren't so bad."
He offers one to Helmut, but Helmut shakes his head no. He fears he will throw up if he eats one bite. May, a Saturday afternoon. Opa gives Helmut and Gerhard and Hans money for the movies. They buy their tickets and climb into the balcony seats. They wait for the feature, a Western, to begin. Helmut loves Westerns. He loves the American Wild West, its cowboys, the gunfights, the fistfights. He loves the feeling of losing himself in the action, the same way he feels when he reads his brother's Carl May adventure novels, which are also set in America. The theater lights dim. A black-and-white newsreel flickers on the screen. The boys and girls stir, restless for the main feature. But the newsreel interests Helmut. This one shows a huge bonfire that took place in the courtyard outside the university library in Berlin. Students wearing uniforms and swastika armbands are tossing books onto the burning pyre. The books arc, and their covers spread like a bird's wings as they soar toward the fire.
"From now on," intones the narrator, "Germans will read only German books by German authors, books that promote strong, traditional German ideals. We will not have our minds poisoned by Jews and others who promote liberal ideas."
In the newsreel, the students cheer. All around Helmut, boys and girls cheer too, rocking the balcony with their stamping of feet. Helmut feels sickened. He thinks about the Karl May adventure stories. What if the Nazis banned the Karl May Westerns? What if they call them un-German because they are set in the American Wild West? His stomach in turmoil, Helmut doesn't enjoy the movie. He just can't lose himself in the story. Later, at the flat, he hurries to his bedroom and closes the door. He sits on his bed and stares at the bookshelf. He reaches for his brother's novels, pulls them from the shelf. He doesn't want to hide the books, but he fears he must. Helmut stashes them beneath the bed. He finds Gerhard in the living room and sits beside him on the couch. He feels guilty about the hidden books. He knows he's supposed to honor his country and his leaders, and that means to obey, honor, and sustain its laws. That's what the Mormon's 12th article of faith tells him. But must he obey a law that feels wrong?
"Gerhard," says Helmut slowly, "is it ever all right to do something you're not supposed to?"
"What kind of thing are you talking about? Do you mean something illegal, breaking the law?"
Helmut thinks about that.
"Yes," he says. "Is it ever all right to break the law?"
"Breaking the law is serious. But God gave us free agency," says Gerhard. "That means we have the right to choose our own actions. If you choose to break the law to help someone else, or keep someone from harm, then it's justified."
Helmut feels hopeful for a second because Gerhard is right. God did give him free agency. Helmut tries to reason why reading a forbidden book might help someone else. He can't. Suppose it's not to help anyone. If it's for your own convenience and other people could be harmed, then it's wrong. Helmut weighs this answer, tries hard to determine if reading a banned book could harm another person. He doesn't think so.
"What if it's for your own convenience, but no one will be harmed?"
Gerhard's voice turns harsh, judgmental. "Then it's selfish and wrong. You should know better." He looks at Helmut sternly. "Are you thinking of breaking the law? You'd better tell me."
"I've hidden your Karl May books," Helmut admits, exasperated. "They're set in America, and that makes them un-German. I don't want to burn them, and I don't want you to get in trouble."
Gerhard laughs. "You don't have to hide them," he says. "Karl May is Hitler's favorite author, you know? Hitler likes the Wild West, too."
Helmut didn't know. He feels much better. But still he finds Gerhard annoying, the way he knows it all, the way he is so sure of himself, the way he can tell right from wrong as surely as if he were solving long division. The morning sun moves higher on the wall. From down the corridor, Helmut hears footsteps. White-hot fear blazes down his back. The footsteps pass his cell, stop several doors away. The fear turns to cold sweat. It's not him. The rattle of keys, a door swinging open. A guard's voice. "Come with us. It is time." That's what the guards say when they escort a prisoner to the low red brick execution chamber in the courtyard, where the guillotine waits. A wailing sets up.
"No!"
Helmut's stomach turns. He hears blows, the dull thuds of a truncheon, the kick of boots, the shackling of handcuffs. A door slams. Sobs. Footsteps. The drag of feet. A minute passes. 2 minutes. 3. Then, in the distance, metal against metal. The guillotine snaps its iron jaws with a clang that rings throughout the prison. Silence. Helmut's insides turn to water. He rushes to the slop bucket, throws up. He drags his arm across his mouth. He kneels beneath the cell window, closes his eyes, and prays for the soul of his neighbor. Helmut believes in prayer, believes in God, has always believed in God. Even now doesn't believe that God has abandoned him, but has grown closer. For not one sparrow is forgotten before God. That's what the Bible says.